news and issues from a superior point of view.
It's the 300th anniversary of one of the world's greatest choral works, and the combined choruses of two of our area's colleges bring it to you. But first,
I'm grateful for the great sunshine, the beautiful sky.
We can all be grateful for the skies above our region.
And that plays right into my passion, which of course is night sky photography.
Travis Novisky has spent years photographing those skies, especially at night. Welcome to Simply Superior. I'm Robin Washington. Travis Novisky is a park manager for the Minnesota Department of Natural Resources and an enrolled member in the Grand Portage Band of Lake Superior, Chippewa. He's also a nature and wildlife photographer who has taken countless images of the night sky. This week, he shared his vast experiences and relationship with the night sky, both cultural and professional, with members of the group BIPOC Outdoors Twin Ports at a gathering before a crackling campfire at Gooseberry Falls State Park. I was invited to tag along. Here are excerpts from his presentation.
Grand Portage, you know, northeast Minnesota has some of the most dramatic terrain that Minnesota has to offer. Rugged mountains, beautiful inland lakes, wild rivers, dense forests, and some of the darkest night skies to be found anywhere. And for a photographer, it is what I call an incredibly rich place to call home. And so lately there's been a lot of attention surrounding the subject of dark skies. And that plays right into my passion, which of course is night sky photography. I was part of a documentary that came out in November of 2022 called Northern Nights, Starry Skies, which celebrates star bright skies, dark sky places, indigenous star knowledge, and our stewardship of the night sky. It was produced by Hamlet University Center for Global Environmental Education, and along with PBS North out of Duluth. And you can view that by searching Northern Nights Starry Skies on YouTube. I also had a book come out just this past November called Spirits Dancing, which is about the night sky, indigenous knowledge, and living connections to the cosmos. The book features my photography. I think there's about 160 photos in it. And the text was written by Annette Lee, who is one of the founders of Native Sky Watchers. It was published by the Minnesota Historical Society Press and is available through most booksellers. I like to remind people that, you know, I speak just for myself, right? Like kind of we all do. We speak for ourselves and the history and the experiences that each of us have had, right? And there are different ways of learning. There are different ways things are taught. And so what I share with you tonight are just the ways that I've learned things and ways that that knowledge has come into my knowledge set, I guess you might say. So jumping back to this concept of the earth and sky being relatives, this can be related to the seven directions as well. Of course, we all know the four cardinal directions, right? This direction we have Giwaydin, which is north, Jawan, south, Waban, east, and Ningabian would be west. And these directions can also represent ceremonial plants, tobacco, sweetgrass, sage, and cedar, and other things like seasons of the year, stages of life, etc. We also have Ishpeming in the sky. And we have Akid, which is earth. But there's a seventh direction. Does anybody have a guess as to what that is or know what that is? Yep, inward. That seventh direction is within us. In Ojibwe, as we'd say, Inde, my heart, or Ode, which just means heart, and which consequently is, that's why we call strawberries Ode Amin, or the heart-shaped berry. And that center direction, or within us, refers to the fire that we each carry within. Whether it's through the knowledge we have or through our experiences and associations, we are responsible for maintaining that fire. Sometimes people would ask, you know, how is your fire burning today? And it would make that person think of what they'd gone through that day. If they'd been offensive to anyone, or perhaps if they had been offended by someone else. And they would reflect on that because it has to do a lot with nurturing that fire within. And so we are taught at a very early age to let go of any distractions of the day by making peace within ourselves so that we can nurture and maintain our fire. Another concept I'd like to touch on real quickly is that of two-eyed seeing, as discussed by Mi'kmaq elders Merdane and Albert Marshall. Two-eyed seeing is learning to see from one eye with the strengths of indigenous knowledges and ways of knowing, and from the other eye with the strengths of Western knowledges and ways of knowing, and to use both eyes for the benefit of all. The Marshalls call this the gift of multiple perspectives, and they refer to seeing with both eyes for the benefit of all as the most important part. But if there's one thing I'd like you to take away from today's presentation, it is that it's kind of this little message, I guess, that it's always wise to be mindful of everything that we do. And in thinking of positive ways to work together and move forward, we can think of the Ojibwe phrase, Mino Bamadzi Win, which this phrase can be translated multiple ways, but most commonly I hear it as that we live in a good way. Okay, as I mentioned earlier, I alluded to the fact that I'm almost 50. I just turned 48 in December. So to give you a little perspective, I've been playing with cameras since about eighth grade, so it's been quite a while. That was when I got my first camera, I think, for my birthday that year, which was just a real basic point-and-shoot Pentax. And since then, I've had a slew of cameras up to the latest, you know, Nikon digital mirrorless camera that I have now. But I am primarily a self-taught nature and wildlife photographer. My photography focuses mainly on my native homelands in this area that is also known as the Heart of the Continent region. But I've also traveled fairly extensively throughout the West, Southwest, and Alaska. But I'm always drawn back to the beauty that we have here in this most unique of places, that is Minnesota. And one of the reasons I love our state so much is because it is, of course, my ancestral homeland, with my family history going back, I mean, I don't even know how far, but also because it's an oasis of darkness. You know, I heard comments earlier about Duluth being hard to see stars and things, but it's nice because if you can drive even just 20 to 30 minutes, makes a huge difference, and that's pretty unique to be able to do that, to live in a city but not have good quality dark skies not very far away. So I've loved the night sky for pretty much as long as I can remember. From nights spent with my dad while he was capturing images of the sky on film, to after dark walks with my mom, to moonlit hikes and bike rides, the night sky for me has always been there and I've always loved it. It's a different world from that of the daylight hours. As I often like to say, nighttime is a magic time. The world looks different at night, more mysterious. Sound travels differently. The quality of light on the landscape defies description. And nights spent under the glow of a sky filled with stars or the dancing lights of the Aurora Borealis are some of the best memories that I have. These experiences stick with you and increase your appreciation for the outdoors like few other experiences.
You're listening to excerpts from a talk about the night sky by Travis Novitsky, a park manager for the Minnesota Department of Natural Resources and an enrolled member in the Grand Portage Band of Lake Superior Chippewa. He spoke to the BIPOC Outdoors Twin Ports group at Gooseberry Falls State Park. Here again is Travis Nowbiski.
So as much as I love photographing the night sky, I also love the simple act of just being with it and experiencing it. And for me, it's my number one anchor that keeps me kind of grounded and centered. And oftentimes, the most notable quality of the night is how quiet it can be. I have experienced many nights where that silence is almost deafening. But sometimes, in order to really hear that, to hear that silence, so to speak, you need to kind of push everything out of your mind and let yourself truly be there in that moment, which is, you know, more often than not an easy thing to do. Our minds tend to always be running with some sort of thought or memory. Our subconscious always replaying that day's events, or, you know, maybe we're thinking about what might happen tomorrow, what sort of meetings we have to go to or something like that. And most of the time, I don't think we even realize that we're doing that. And that's why I like the night sky so much. Because for me, anyway, it's the easiest way that I can quiet my mind and just be there in the present. So I spend countless hours in the daylight scouting for possible locations to photograph at night. Whether it's hiking or just driving around in the state or national forest on some gravel roads, or out canoeing or biking, even skiing and snowshoeing. I always, when I'm doing these things, kind of have an eye that's on the lookout for potential locations for photographing at night. And when I find a lake that has an intriguing curve to the shoreline with some nice pine trees or some other foreground element, I will be looking at that direction, or at the direction, and thinking ahead. You know, in my mind, I'll be trying to visualize what that area might look like at night, whether the Milky Way would line up or whether it would be a good spot for some northern lights. And then I'll start to plan for when I might want to go back there at night to try and photograph these things. And in some cases, there are many, many hours, if not days, invested in scouting a location. And sometimes even years will pass before I make it back there to photograph it at night. While mindfulness can be practiced pretty much anytime and anywhere, it's moments like these portrayed in this photo here that I find the most beneficial. When I come across a scene like this, you know, yes, I'm taking some time to survey the scene and set up my tripod to make some photographs, but I'm also taking time to just sit there and be with everything around me. So usually I'll set my tripod camera up first, but then I'll typically sit down or I'll lay on the ground for several minutes and just listen to what's going on around me. And on this particular night, Lake Superior was incredibly calm. And the only sounds it made came from the lapping of the smallest of waves on the shoreline. As I sat there taking in this amazing view, I could hear a few frogs croaking from the wetland behind me. I also heard the repetitive, almost mechanical sound of a beaver chewing on a piece of wood. I could feel the light touch of mosquitoes as they danced across the surface of my exposed arms. And I also noticed the intoxicating aromas of the forest, the rich scents of pine and spruce, the intense fragrance of the humidity of the water surrounding me. And taking the time to notice each of these things helps you appreciate each of them in their own way. Keeping an open mind and recognizing that each of these elements all have their place and purpose in nature helps me come away with a deeper sense of the necessity of all these things. So for me, even though I grew up on a reservation, Indigenous star knowledge has been pretty hard to come by. There just aren't that many people, at least in my community, that seemed to know a whole lot about it. Or if they did know about it, you know, those stories weren't shared with me or revealed to me as I was growing up. So it's been quite an education and quite an honor getting to know Carl Gaboy and Annette Lee, as they have shared some of what they've learned over their lifetimes of putting some of these pieces of star knowledge together. To this day, Carl and Annette both continue to study the connection that Indigenous people have with astronomy and constellations. And they've graciously given me permission to share in my presentations some of the knowledge that I've learned from them. And I will say with the disclaimer here that normally there are always certain stories that can only be told in the wintertime and are still underground. This has been a hard winter for that because we haven't had any snow. Some of this knowledge is protected. Most of it has not been written down, and much has been lost due to colonization. The connection between the aurora and the dancing spirit lights comes from the Ojibwe phrase, Jibaya Nima Idawag, which refers to the northern lights or aurora borealis. Jibaya translates as ghosts or spirits, and Nima Idawag translates as they dance. Another Ojibwe word for the northern lights is Wawate, which is what I've heard most commonly growing up, which, as far as I know, means simply there is a display of northern lights. You know, we've learned, or has been explained, that northern lights are caused most often by the solar wind stream, which, you know, at certain times slips into our atmosphere and then has these charged particles that burn up in the atmosphere, producing these colorful light shows. So it is literally like the solar wind stream creating these lights, like wind, flashing light wind. I think it's cool. Interesting correlation. But this concept of Jibaya Nima Idawag, or spirits dancing, also relates to the Ojibwe teaching about the Milky Way, or the Jibaya Zibih, the river of souls. As Ojibwe scholar and elder Carl Ogabwe explains, when the soul departs, it travels a path to the west. After other trials, the soul comes to a great shining river, one whose reflection can be seen in the night sky, the Milky Way. The Ojibwe understanding of the Milky Way relates to the spirit returning to the stars along the Jibaya Zibih. The soul gets in a waiting canoe and paddles the river to the great beyond and greets all the friends and relatives. When we look up at the night sky and see the northern lights, it is our relatives dancing. The night sky is not solely an abstract collection of facts that exists externally to be measured, but rather like a close relative who exists nearby and whose influence is vast. So in closing, I'd like to quote Annette one more time from the Spirits Dancing book. Annette writes, "For millennia, humans have gazed at the night sky in awe and wonder. Western science provides fascinating insights into the physics of what we witness. Indigenous knowledge asserts powerful human connections to the stars and the northern lights. Our own quiet observation strengthens and deepens our relationship to the sky. With careful attention, we can feel our connection to generations past who have shared these emotions and curiosity. And we can recognize our connection to future generations and our responsibility for preserving this experience for them." And with that, I'd like to say Miigwech. Thank you. I talked for a long time, so I hope everybody isn't too antsy.
You've been listening to excerpts from a presentation about the night sky by Travis Novitsky, a park manager for the Minnesota Department of Natural Resources and an enrolled member in the Grand Portage Band of Lake Superior Chippewa. He spoke to the BIPOC Outdoors Twin Ports Group at Gooseberry Falls State Park. Although his home is on the Minnesota side of our listening area, Travis offered one tip for viewing the aurora borealis that's of particular interest to Wisconsinites. The best place to view them is the south shore of Lake Superior, which gives a clear, unimpeded view of the northern sky that you can't see from Duluth or the North Shore. Since I've never seen them after decades of trying, I know where I'm headed the next time they're suspected to be out. Coming up, two local college choirs celebrate 300 years of a choral masterpiece. Yeah. Welcome back to Simply Superior. I'm Robin Washington. The University of Wisconsin-Superior Music Department has had a wealth of public concerts this season, and in particular, the university's chorus. Earlier this month, it held a moving performance of the Music of Terezin, composed in the Terezin concentration camp during the Holocaust. At the beginning of April, the chorus will combine with that of the College of St. Scholastica to present J.S. Bach's St. John's Passion on the 300th anniversary of the work. Leading the chorus is Professor Michael Fuchs, who's just published a book on the St. John Passion, and he joins me now along with student Elise Bessonen. Welcome to Wisconsin Public Radio, Michael and Elise.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
So is this season busier than normal, or is there a normal? Not long ago, I was talking to you and your colleagues, Michael, about students having to perform virtually during the pandemic. So have we busted out of the cage and we're making up for that?
Oh, totally. I think we are back to the normal level of busy. But this year, there seeming to always be a kind of a special project right around the corner. And this one coming up in April with the St. John Passion is one that we've had on our radar for a couple of years now, and it's fun to see it come to fruition.
And is that because it is the 300th anniversary of the work?
Yeah, it's the 300th anniversary of the work. It's music that I've always found to be really meaningful and powerful. And then I did dive into it heavily in the past few years as part of my own personal scholarship with the book that I just published. And so I wanted to share that music and that insight with the students in at the university and at St. Scholastica, and also with the community.
Well, Elise, you're a junior music education major and also a member of the women's basketball team, I understand. What position do you play, or I should say, what positions do you play in both?
So I am a point guard for the basketball team, and I'm an alto here in choir. So,
you know, I'm reminded of the late Peter Schickele, or PDQ Bach, and his routine in which he does a play-by-play of a symphony as a sports broadcast. So every time I hear, like, the DSSO plays Mahler, I think of the Twins play the White Sox. So, Elise, I think you have a promising future by putting both of your professions together here. Having gone this far, are there any musical aspects of basketball other than, you know, the cheering section? It definitely is choreographed.
Definitely. I would say games for sure have an ebb and flow, kind of like we have that in music.
Well, when you're playing Mahler, I'll be in your cheering section. So, Michael, turning to something terribly serious, your performance of the Music of Terezin, is this music written by those who were in the camps, and what precipitated your performing it?
Well, the Music of Terezin, we performed that a couple weeks ago on March 5th, and that was music actually written in the camps by composers and performed there by people that were imprisoned there in Terezin. And then about half of the music was also set to poetry that was written in the camps, and specifically children's poetry. When they liberated the camp at the end of World War II, they found hundreds of poems kind of hidden behind panels or under mattresses that children had written while in Terezin. And those poems have become a staple for many composers as texts that they use to set to music. So we had both music and a lot of music, and especially poetry that was written during that time.
Mm-hmm. And the two composers are Pavel Haas and Gideon Klein. Tell us about them.
Yeah, so Pavel Haas and Gideon Klein. Haas was kind of at the height of his career when he was interred in Terezin. And he had a wealth of music that he had already written in his life. And then he came to Terezin and continued to write music as a way of resistance to the Nazis. And his music is filled with nationalistic symbols and a longing for homeland. Gideon Klein was much younger than Haas. I think he was in his 20s and a real rising star in the musical world when he was imprisoned.
Mm-hmm.
Both of them died in the Holocaust towards the end of the war in 1944 and 1945.
Hmm. Well, let's hear the University of Wisconsin-Superior Chorus with Music of Terezin by Pavel Haas and Gideon Klein. And that was the University of Wisconsin-Superior Chorus with Music of Terezin by Pavel Haas and Gideon Klein, two composers who perished at the concentration camp during the Holocaust. With us are Professor Michael Fuchs and alto student Elise Bessonen. Anyone else you want to highlight in that performance, Michael?
Well, we were thrilled to have two guest faculty members join us for that performance. Dr. Vicky Singleton and Dr. Greg Moore did a set of pieces to poems written in Terezin. It was just wonderful to have them performing some really contemporary and beautiful, beautiful music.
Well, looking forward, and I would say certainly on a much more cheerful note, you have a much larger and grander work combining your chorus with that of the College of St. Scholastica to mark the 300th anniversary of Bach's St. John Passion. And Michael, as you alluded to earlier, you wrote the book on it, literally. Your book was just published last fall. Tell us the name of it.
Well, the book is called Bach's St. John Passion for the 21st Century. I was a co-author with the Reverend Bradley Jensen, who lives in Duluth. And so I tackled the musical elements of the work, and Brad tackled the theological elements of the work. And what we found as we went through this was that it's just really fascinating how this music that was written over 300 years ago, and not just its age, but the specific purpose for which it was written, for a very particular worship service in Leipzig on Good Friday, has just kind of survived and flourished and become a piece that is in the staple of Western music and continues to receive performances and recordings. And we wanted to ask ourselves why. Why does this piece still capture the hearts and minds and the attention of so many musicians and audiences?
Mm-hmm.
And I think at its heart, the piece just has so much humanity to it and so much power in how Bach shapes the narrative, whether one approaches the music from a religious perspective or not.
Well, Bach was one of the most prolific composers, and this wasn't his only passion, pun intended, I guess. He also had the St. Matthew Passion, and I'm going to give a true confession from my very early broadcasting days at my college station. I was doing a classical show, and I said, and now let's hear Bach's St. Matthew Passion. And I put the record on and then realized it was like a 5-record set, because it went on for about 3 hours or something like that. Elise, you're probably the age I was then, and you're, I'm sure, not making stupid mistakes like that one. What's special about this work for you? Or tell us, you know, how you're approaching it, and again, what's special about it?
Yeah, I was super excited to hear that we were going to get to do this work. We actually had taken a look at it some last year in our singers group here at the college, and I didn't get to perform because I went home for Easter, but it was just a really fun piece to work on. It's super challenging, super rewarding. Honestly, these rehearsals, as frustrating as they can be sometimes, they're some of the most exciting that I've been a part of, and I really enjoy getting to work on it with my colleagues. And
Elise is not only singing in the chorus, but she also has a solo, and many of the solo roles and solo parts are being sung by students at this performance, which is quite ambitious.
How do you prepare for your solo?
We work on solos in like our applied lessons, so it was just, you know, kind of coming at it with that mindset and working. I usually take lessons with Dr. Fingelson, but she's on sabbatical, so I've been working with Professor Pierce, and she's been great, and we've really been enjoying working on this aria together.
And how long is it? Just for anyone who knows, once I said it, you know, he had a 3-hour long passion. I want to warn our audiences or prepare them.
Well, the St. John is not as long as the St. Matthew.
Okay.
So St. John moves a little bit quicker. It clocks in at a little under 2 hours of music. So with an intermission, you're probably looking at about 2 hours and 15 minutes or so.
All right. Well, since I'm not going to make the mistake I made a few decades ago, we won't play the whole thing, but we will play a snippet from a recording of the St. John Passion. Michael, you recommended a particular recording?
Yeah. Let's listen to the Netherlands Bach Society play part of the opening chorus.
All right. To give you a sneak preview of the upcoming concert by the University of Wisconsin Superior Chorus and that of the College of St. Scholastica, here is the Netherlands Bach Society with the opening chorus of Bach's St. John Passion. Thank you. And that was a portion of the opening chorus of Johann Sebastian Bach's St. John Passion, performed by the Netherlands Bach Society. It's a sneak preview of the performances of the Passion by the combined choruses of the University of Wisconsin-Superior and the College of St. Scholastica. They'll be performing it on Saturday, April 6th at 7:30 p.m. at the Cathedral of Our Lady in Duluth, and on Sunday, April 7th at 3 p.m. at Pilgrim Lutheran Church in Superior. We're speaking with UWS music professor Michael Fuchs and third-year student and alto and soloist Elise Bessonen. Your performance marks the 300th anniversary of the work, and speaking of anniversaries, Bach just had a birthday, am I correct?
Yeah, it is coming up, although there's a couple of dates that they use for it, depending on who you ask about it.
Well, I thought it was March 21st. That's what I've been celebrating every year.
Well, it's either the 21st or the 31st because they changed the calendar. There is a little controversy or disagreement on whether it's the 21st or the 31st.
All right. Well, a whole bunch of radio stations have been doing these Bach Fests on the 21st. And who knows? Maybe it's an excuse for a second Bach Fest. And hey, you wrote the book about it, so your opinion is worth something. So. So what else is coming up?
Well, one that I would love to also highlight is the musical Ride the Cyclone that will be happening in the middle of April. There'll be six performances of that on April 12th, 13th, 17th, and 20th. Those dates are at 7:30 p.m. and on April 14th and April 21st at 2 p.m.
And where are they?
That's going to be in the Holden Fine and Applied Arts Center and Mannion Theater on the campus of UW-Superior.
Great. And you can find out about this by going to the website, www.uwsuper.edu, and then search for music department. Elise, how about the basketball season? Give us an update.
Yeah, it was a pretty solid year. We ended up winning the regular season conference. Unfortunately, we lost in the tournament conference championship, but I think that we had a great year. We've got a lot returning for next year, and we're just having a lot of fun.
And you did win that game against Mahler, correct?
Sure.
Although it was a little touch and go there in the fourth movement, I understand. Well, we've been speaking with Professor Michael Fuchs of the University of Wisconsin-Superior Music Department and with student Elise Bessonen. Thank you for joining us, Michael and Elise.
Thank you for having us.
Thank
you.
Our pleasure.
Welcome back to Simply Superior. I'm Robin Washington, and we're joined by Rick Lubbers of the Duluth News Tribune. Hello, Rick.
Hi, Robin.
So, Rick, earlier this year, you reported on the sentence of time served to the terminally ill elderly man who pled guilty to stealing the ruby slippers from the Judy Garland Museum. Now a second elderly man has been charged in the caper.
Yes, that pair of ruby slippers that's seen in The Wizard of Oz has been returned to its owner by the FBI. And a second man, who is 76 years old, has been indicted for his alleged role in the infamous theft. That second suspect in the August 2005 heist made an initial appearance Friday in U.S. District Court in St. Paul. Jerry Hal Sliderman was charged with one count of theft of major artwork for receiving, concealing, and disposing of the ruby slippers, which he allegedly knew were stolen, according to the indictment that was unsealed Sunday. Sliderman is 76 and lives in Crystal, Minnesota, according to state court records. The indictment comes 10 months after Terry John Martin, a 77-year-old Grand Rapids man, was indicted for his role in the theft. The indictment of Sliderman is just two pages long and does not detail how he was allegedly involved in stealing the ruby slippers or how he is connected to Martin. Martin confessed in October that he used a small sledgehammer to smash a glass door at the museum and then using the same implement to shatter a case containing a pair of ruby slippers used in the shooting of the 1939 musical film. Martin told the court that he briefly stored the artifacts in a trailer near his home before giving them to a fence. Having never seen the movie and apparently not realizing their cultural value, Martin said he mistakenly believed the slippers actually contained rubies. When he was informed they did not, Martin said he didn't want anything else to do with them. Now, Martin did not name the fence during the plea hearing. His attorney told the News Tribune at the time that there was no further cooperation agreement beyond his testimony in court. Martin, who was under home hospice care, was spared a prison sentence in January. Instead, he has been placed on supervised release and required to pay back $23,000 in restitution. Sliderman has a criminal record in Minnesota dating back to the 1980s that includes felony convictions for theft, receiving stolen goods, and possession of burglary tools. He was released Friday with conditions, including that he show up to future court hearings and remain in Minnesota, according to federal court records. Meanwhile, Hollywood collector and acting coach Michael Shaw traveled to the Judy Garland Museum in Grand Rapids on February 1st, where he was reunited with the shoes nearly two decades after they were swiped while on loan to the actress's birthplace museum. Shaw, according to the museum, plans to bring the artifacts on a worldwide tour before putting them up for auction later this year. The museum is said to be working diligently to find a way to purchase the slippers, according to executive director Janie Heitz. The FBI stated that it was incredibly honored to return the ruby slippers to the rightful owner. One of the four surviving pairs worn by Garland and the Wizard of Oz, the slippers were appraised at upward of $3.5 million. Shaw allowed the shoes to be exhibited at the Grand Rapids Museum in 1989, 1992, and 2004.
Well, also on the crime beat, but perhaps the total opposite of plotting to steal historical objects, a Duluth man is charged with impulsively shooting through a neighbor's door because he was annoyed by a sewage leak.
Yes, the Duluth man allegedly sent two shotgun blasts through his upstairs neighbor's door because he believed sewage was leaking into his apartment. The 34-year-old suspect had been trying to fight the three tenants for reasons unknown to them, according to court filings. He allegedly attempted to kick in the door before ultimately firing the shots. The criminal complaint says the incident occurred March 10 in a duplex on East 6th Street, but it was not reported to Duluth Police Department until 3 days later. Two tenants were home when the suspect reportedly tried to break in through a shared hallway door. A short time later, two loud bangs were heard, and the roommate saw holes in both the door and a wall inside the apartment. When officers spoke with the suspect, he admitted to being angry about the sewage supposedly leaking into his apartment. He claimed to have shot a firework at the door, but denied shooting a gun. He did, however, acknowledge having a 12-gauge double-barrel shotgun, which police seized. The complaint says the shotgun slug was recovered from the ceiling of the neighbor's unit, along with two shells found on landing below the stairs. The suspect was arraigned Friday, March 15, on account of second-degree assault with a dangerous weapon, and bail was set at $50,000. St. Louis County Prosecutor Nate Stummy told the court that family members reported that the suspect's criminal history includes a domestic violence no-contact order violation and criminal damage to property convictions in 2022. Two other domestic violence cases were dismissed in recent years, one of which came as a result of meeting court-ordered conditions. He remains in St. Louis County Jail, and his next appearance in court is set for April 9.
All right. And on an enlightening note, several nonprofits in Minnesota are among recipients of grants from one of the country's leading philanthropists.
Yes, billionaire Mackenzie Scott is handing out $640 million to nonprofit organizations across the nation this year, including several in Minnesota. Through her organization, Yield Giving, Scott has already given away $17.3 billion of her wealth to over 2,300 different nonprofits, according to her website. She says she has no intention of stopping. She intends to give away a majority of her wealth back to society. With 6,000 applications and 361 organizations receiving funding nationwide, there are organizations in Minnesota that each received a seven-figure boost from Yield Giving. Gender Justice was given $2 million to support their efforts to advance gender equity through the law. And for their work advocating for members of the LGBTQ plus community, Outfront Minnesota was given $2 million. Also in Minnesota, WellShare International out of Minneapolis received $2 million to help promote access to healthcare and public health infrastructure across all races, ethnicities, and neighborhoods. Appetite for Change, a Minneapolis-based group, was given $2 million to harness food as a societal change maker by helping communities grow healthier and wealthier. Scott was once married to Jeff Bezos, founder of online shopping giant Amazon, and has a 4% stake in the company.
All right. Well, on the Wisconsin side, here's a fun story, or perhaps a funny man story. The city of Superior has tapped Emmy Award-winning comedian Charlie Behrens to be his pitch man and help attract tourism. Our WPR colleague Danielle Kading has the story.
Charlie Behrens has drawn millions of followers on social media for his creations like Manitowoc Minute. The Wisconsin comedian is known for his irreverent tone and Midwest accent. Under the contract, Behrens would produce videos endorsing the city that would be posted on his social media accounts. Lindsay Grasky with the Superior City Council says it's a way to attract visitors.
I think it's just going to reach a lot of people and be a really huge stepping stone for exposing the beauty of Superior and kind of getting us known in the state of Wisconsin, truly.
Some council members voice concerns about the amount of spending or whether his followers may visit the city. Under the contract, Behrens would not work for competitors like the city of Duluth during the 90-day term that's set to begin in June.
And that was our WPR colleague, Danielle Kading. We've been joined by Rick Lubbers, executive editor of the Duluth News Tribune. Thank you, Rick.
Thank you, Robin.
You can stay updated on these stories anytime at DuluthNewsTribune.com and WPR.org. And that's it for this edition of Simply Superior. I'm Robin Washington. We leave you with another selection from Bach's St. John Passion. Stay safe, everyone.
Ach, wo soll ich mich erquicken?